Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us again here on The Avid Reader. We really appreciate it, as does my bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. So our guest today is Kate Lebo, author of The Book of Difficult Fruit, Arguments for the Tart, Tender, and Unruly, with recipes. This is her first collection of essays published by FSG in April. Kate is the author of Pie School, co-editor of Pie and Whiskey, and A Commonplace Book of Pies. And she makes pies at culinary centers all across America or at your own home. So you can check out her website, which is easy because it's katelebo.com, for lots of good information, including her great essays and poetry. And you can also talk to her on Twitter and Instagram. So The Book of Difficult Fruit is a kind of lexicon, an ABC Darien, or however it's pronounced, journey to a land of the tart, the sweet, the garbagey, the astringent, the aromatic fruit that are so difficult to peel or cut, difficult to prepare, and sometimes difficult to eat. So although I was familiar with most on a surface level, of course, a few were unknown to me, like face clock, which sounds like a new spatial temporal form of social networking, and lump, which is something I don't like when said by a doctor since it might be suspicious. And I was familiar with xylitol since my vet said to stop feeding gummy bears to my dog. And there's also some stuff about cigarettes and smoking, which made me want to go out and buy a pack of Marlboros. Since Kate's husband, Sam, waxes longingly over his perhaps misguided promises to kick them until he was 70, and I'm turning 69 on Friday. Anyway, before my introduction becomes another one of my monologues, welcome, Kate, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam. It's good to be here.
So, shall we begin with durian?
Why not?
Okay, let's go. I was in Singapore. I was walking through the market. I smelled something that was so horrible. And then I looked down and saw this thing that looked like an enlarging ray of the coronavirus. And talk about durian.
It's a fantastic fruit, right?
Yeah, it's fantastic, but I don't want it anywhere around me or on my bus, which where it's banned.
I was surprised. So I live in Spokane, Washington. It fresh durian to get to where I am has to come a very long way. It took me about 2 years to find a fresh one. And once I finally found one, like it was so spiny and so heavy, I had to wrap it in my sweater to get it to the counter. And once I got it to the counter, the gal there kept asking me, are you sure you want this fruit? Are you sure? Every single time I bought durian, the person I bought it from would question the wisdom of me buying it.
I thought it was very honest of you to admit the second time around that you didn't know how to cut it.
Sure. After lying, because I got shy.
And I was just like me.
I'm not going to pass this durian test, am I? And she knows it. But it was, and that questioning was funny. It was interesting. It was this cool kind of point of connection with somebody in my community. But it also was a moment where I realized, like, oh, they probably have people come in here with some expectations of these fruits that once they get them home, they're like, what is this? They don't necessarily have a taste for it for, you know, one reason or another, whether because they've never seen it before, because they've got a westernized kind of palate that isn't used to these more pungent Southeast Asian flavors. But I realized in talking to these people who I was buying the durian from, they were trying to tell me, like, you can't bring this back. Okay, if you buy it, get ready. You cannot bring it back. It's not our problem if you don't like it.
It's like you're talking it up now, like it's okay. But in your chapter, you kind of say, I've eaten an enormous amount of it, but only to write this chapter.
Exactly. Yeah. No, and I've had both experiences at this point, with the experience of really not liking it, really having that, you know, that it did smell like a sewer. It did smell like onions and kind of this melon, you know, going bad in the back of your car. And as I was writing, so I was feeling really worried about, I guess, repeating some of the judgments of durian that I have encountered. And that frankly introduced me to durian in the first place, the kind of clickbaity articles that are like, world's stinkiest fruit, gross fruit, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I think that people who enjoy durian people who are of a Southeast Asian background are probably, you know, rightfully sick of that kind of reaction and that judgment, right? But I was having that experience. So what was I supposed to do with it? And what I found was, through trying to make sure that the adjectives that I was using to describe this experience that was terribly typical, I started to develop a taste for the fruit. So you'll see in the durian chapter, it ends with me, you know, gratefully throwing it out, just giving up, right? But what's fun about the form of this book is that the head notes in each recipe, there's two recipes of each that follow each essay. So the head notes within each of those recipes offer another opportunity to come back and reconsider and bring in more information. So you'll see in the head notes of those recipes kind of another encounter with the fruit where I made some peace with it. I found out actually through trying it with another friend, a friend who didn't have a taste for it, that as she was shocked and bothered by what she was tasting, I was actually kind of enjoying myself.
Yeah, but your friend and your husband both despised it.
It's true. No, it's just not for everybody. But the people who love it, is from what I've read.
Yeah.
Hey, somewhere in the middle.
Did you happen to see that there was an article in this week's New Yorker called Yuck? There's a book called Yuck, and it's about foods that are challenging at best, and he gives you a run for your money because he tries this thing called hákarl, which is Icelandic shark, which he says tastes, much like you would, tastes like gnawing on three-week-old cheese from the garbage that had also been pissed on by every dog in the neighborhood.
Oh, God, yum.
You have to read that then.
I did. I mentioned that dish in durian as well as I'm trying to consider, you know, these foods that we consider stinky often can become, are often important to particular cultures. I mean, and are often a mark of you being outside of a culture. If you don't appreciate it, it might be a sign of kind of your lack of experience with that culture, well, or just not belonging to it, you know?
What about
if you, neither good nor bad. It's just how it is.
What if you leave fruit, like say, for example, like haggis. Have you had haggis?
I have, yeah.
And?
It's fine. I didn't love it. I didn't love it. Yeah. I didn't pursue haggis as determinedly as I pursued durian to try to figure out why people loved it and what did this taste like, but it was okay.
Yeah, except that would throw up. I think, well, so, okay, let's switch then. So let's go to something more, okay, like the chapter on whole wheat.
Sure.
So why, I mean, I read it, so I know, but tell us why whole wheat is difficult.
Sure. So wheat is an incredibly important substance to the Western diet. It is, you know, the queen of baking, the queen and the king of baking. It gives your bread heft and taste and structure. And it's just in so many things that we love. It's also a really important economic staple for North America, for the United States, and for Canada in particular. And it is also, as it's being milled, produces a lot of dust. And in the past, before we had, you know, good dust collection systems, would create really hazardous working conditions, not only for workers whose sweat would combine with the dust to become dough on their bodies. Can you imagine just a day at the office coming out covered in dough? It would also get in their lungs, right? Miller's lung. But it wasn't the dust itself. It was a mite in the dust that would cause that Miller's lung. But it also was incredibly explosive. So in the My Wheat chapter, I write about a terrible conflagration that happened in Minneapolis on the shores of the Mississippi River at St. Anthony Falls at the Washburn A. Mill in 1878. Just two dry millstones met, they sparked, and they set off an explosion that killed numerous people, killed the entire workforce that was working that night, and took out, you know, blocks around it. That became a really interesting metaphor for me as I was learning about this. I learned about this because I actually went to the Mill City Museum in Minneapolis. It's really, really fun if you are a baker, just anyone interested in wheat. And as I was learning about this terrible tragedy, I started to think about a situation I'd had in my life where I was in the process of becoming a baker and learning to express myself through food and through the writing I was doing about food. And my partner at the time was starting to learn that he had celiac disease, which seemed like just this terrible kind of Romeo and Juliet situation. And of course we had other problems, but one of the ways to, that I started through this story about the Mill City Museum, or sorry, excuse me, about the Washburn A. Mill accident, the way I started to think about that story within my life was as this kind of way to get at the elements of wheat that are not just nurturing, that are not just sweet, delicious, not just stuff that we crave, but a way that our nurturing can perhaps start to harm. So I had to kind of investigate how my habits of nurturing within my relationship, the way that they are tied to how I love to bake, what I hope to give when I give people baked goods, how those, as you know, my partner was getting sick, well, was discovering why he was sick. And as we were kind of figuring out our own, maybe we can just call it like codependent problems, a way for me to I guess, understand the way that like habits of nurturing can become smothering and to the self and to the other person and can become unhealthy, even though they look, sweet and easy and good.
Yeah, there were tons of analogies. Hey, so not to go back to Durian, but was this guy the same guy who would never love you?
No, there's plenty. Who would never love me.
I remember when I worked for my dad in construction, we used to clean out the basements and there was boxes of sawdust from the, which is like wheat. It's because the oxygen surrounds it. And we'd throw it on the fire. And one time it just exploded, burned off my eyebrows and the hair on my arms. And I said, Dad, why do you tell me this? He goes, because you'll learn better if it happens to you. I think I would have learned better if you just told me not to do it. That's how he was. It was just,
That's funny. No, it can be hard to believe. I had a hard time believing that wheat could do that to a baby.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Just as I had a hard time believing that, baking pie and perhaps getting flour in the air could be hurting my partner.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
In a difficult way.
Hey, so I just thought, since I'm a bookseller, I always forget. We need to talk about the cover the epigraph. You got it there? I have it here.
I have it. I also have the British version. If you want to see it.
I need to. Let me see the British cover.
Also, it's got these gleaming gooseberries on the cover.
Oh, that's nice.
I know. They know.
Both of them are nice.
They know what to do with gooseberries.
It's really funny how publishers know how to make covers because they need to sell books. Right. And everyone who comes into my bookstore, that's what they look at. That's why they don't let the authors do it, generally. So the epigraph is from Elizabeth Luard. And you can go ahead and read it and talk about it a little bit.
So she says, and this is such a fantastic, the whole entry is fantastic. If you can get your hands on a copy of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. She says, if sweetness makes fruits desirable, there must also be sharpness. No rose without a thorn. The palate rejects blandness, even when attracted by sweetness.
Yeah, and you reject blandness too. What is the one that you said, no matter what you did, you could, medlar.
Medlar, yeah, that was tough. That was tough to say, but also I found a beautiful use for it, but we'll get to that.
Plus you owe me $30 because when I read the epigraph, I went out and looked at her. I went to Abe Books and she wrote this book called Squirrel Pie. And wow. I had to buy it. So either you owe me the money or
I didn't know that.
Or I'm going to send you, if I send you the book, we even, otherwise you owe me $30. Okay. But I got a first edition because I'm an idiot. Because when I opened the bookstore, everyone said, you cannot be a book collector and a bookseller at the same time.
Says who?
Every bookseller that I talked to. And I totally ignored them. So also when you look up you on YouTube, after your YouTubes, there's a really cool one about how to make a 23-layer butter cake.
Oh, wow.
And it's really cool. They have this like lathe and they just keep rolling it and rolling it and rolling it.
So the algorithm, if you put me in, leads you to a butter cake.
Yeah, which seems nice.
That's fine.
Well, so, okay, this is what I do. So we're trying to sell your book. So it's not about me. Okay, so since you did it as an alphabet, what would you have included if you had more than 26 letters, like what you said about Pinot Noir that you wanted?
Gosh, I would have loved to have done an oyster, like Estrella Lurita. Might not be pronouncing that exactly right, but that's a native oyster to the South Puget Sound, where I lived during the legislative session, and watching people, you know, the oyster beds, going for a walk on that beach and having the oysters wash up. It's pretty magical, and getting to extend the metaphor of fruit to fruits of the sea would have been fun. That's fun story too, because that's a oyster that hasn't been valued by commercial oystering for until recently. Most of the oysters that are farmed in the South Puget Sound are from elsewhere, but with an interest in local aquaculture and stuff, there's starting to be a market for it. So they're these little native Olympia oysters. I would have done them. I would love to have done a mushroom, actually.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
A porcini. Where I live is one of the best wild mushrooming places in the world, from what I hear. Not that I'm a great mushroom hunter myself. I don't go that often because I need someone to go with me. And they're usually busy taking all of their other friends.
Yeah, I've always worried about killing myself by doing that.
Sure, but these mushrooms are like the fruiting bodies of gigantic networks of fungi right beneath the surface of the land. So
that was your whole book talks about poison as well as other stuff too.
Yeah.
Talk about, pick one that's poisonous. It can be poisons.
And that relationship to poison for me, it wasn't necessarily about the poison itself, but it was about this, the relationship between nurturing and harm, and how we use plants and food for medicine, and how our medicines often have this kind of narrow therapeutic index. That's what my doctor neighbor told me this was called. It's kind of a wonky way to say it. But all that means is something that helps in certain amounts or in certain situations, that same thing can also harm. And I was just fascinated by that duality within our food and within our medicines, within plants. A great example of that is in my cherry chapter. So I'm examining something. I mean, we're pretty much probably all familiar with cherries, sweet cherries, sour cherries. I talk about making cherry pie, all the stuff that you would expect from cherries. But as I did a deep dive into cherries, what I learned was that, like all stone fruits, their kernels, which is the soft heart within the hard pit, contain a substance that tastes and smells like almonds, and they contain cyanide. So these two substances split apart when they meet, I think it's when they meet water. So if you were to ingest this kernel, you could taste what I'm talking about. But if you ingested too many kernels, you would start to poison yourself. And that trouble would probably start in the gut. As I did research on that, actually, I was talking to someone from a research university about like how many of these cherry kernels could you until you got in trouble. And they were trying to answer my questions until they realized that I was going to have a recipe for an extract made from cherry kernels, and then they were done. They were like, we can't endorse this in any way. That's a dangerous recipe. And it is a dangerous recipe in that if you drink the entire pint of vodka filled with cherry pits, you will do harm to yourself. Don't do that. But you can have a teaspoon and it's okay. I mean, we're ingesting, cyanide, we're ingesting oxalic acid, we're ingesting all sorts of, even the arsenic, like that's in our rice, for example. We ingest little bits of poison all of the time, and our body can handle that. It's just when we exceed that threshold that we start to get in trouble. So
yeah, I always remember about cyanide smelling like bitter almonds.
Yeah,
it also smells like when you crush a cockroach. That also smells exactly the same way.
Really?
Yeah, try it.
I've never had the pleasure of crushing a cockroach.
Anyway, we're talking about poisons, I know you're not trashing her, but when you talk about Gwyneth Paltrow and you say a diet of ginger and air.
Trashing her a little bit.
Yeah, you are.
A little bit.
Because, you're exactly the opposite. It's, all things in moderation. You're not going to eat 10 pies in a day.
Yeah.
And it's not going to make you fat, and it's not bad for you. But Yeah, I mean, that's an extreme. I think, and I'm sure when you go around the country doing this, I'm sure you're talking about things in moderation. And it's more the process.
Absolutely.
Right.
I'm glad that came through. It is more about the process. It's about, I mean, the real pleasure I get is from making these things. Even, I mean, I love eating them, but I don't think I would engage so deeply with a fruit that's difficult if I didn't enjoy making stuff with fruit and the arduous and repetitive process of making anything with a difficult.
Oh, the ones where you make them and then you have to sit for 3 weeks and then you have to sit for 6 weeks. Wow, that would drive me crazy.
I have a 5-year recipe in this book. How fun. Like it is, so having written a Thai cookbook, which was also fun, but that had to be much more accessible. That was much more of a kind of a teaching text was the way I was thinking about it. I felt like I had this contract with the reader where if they were going to open up my book, my cookbook, Pie School, they were going to learn how to bake a pie that day. Right? Where this book, because I mean, the promise is this is difficult fruit, right? This is not dinner on Tuesday night. This is not, you know, treats in 15 minutes. I had the opportunity to have a recipe that would take 5 years or to have a recipe that requires, you know, two people to help you do it, which is really fun.
I know.
Who knows, like, people will make them. I hope they do. They all work. I promise.
It's like training bonsai trees, which is what I used to do too, to a certain extent. But then I was impatient. Yeah, it's interesting. There are some I didn't think were difficult, but then they kind of were, like vanilla or sugarcane or kiwi.
Right, and that's about revealing difficulties that have been concealed from us by the marketplace.
Oh yeah, when you talk about it was in the New York Times review. What do you talk about? The glistening polished ovaries. What's that phrase?
Yeah, it was like, what was it? It was like a grocery store stack of waxed ovaries or something.
Yeah,
like
she
that.
Loved that. That was
I should know my own mind, but it's something like that.
Yeah, that was
right. And that's, I mean, the idea for this book came in part kind of from the contrast between a quince and a banana, right? So I had my first bite of quince, I encountered this absolutely beautiful, luscious smelling fruit that looked familiar, looked, you know, like a kind of a pregnant pear. And I thought I could probably do what I normally do with an apple or a pear and just take a bite. But anyone who's done that with a quince knows how stupid that is. The quince just wicks all the water from your mouth. It's incredibly astringent. It's also really sour. To really get a pleasant taste from it, you have to cook it for a long time, right? Which made me think about the fruits that I'd gotten used to just growing up, you know, that fruit comes from the grocery store or it comes from, you know, a bush in my parents' yard or my neighbor's yards, or it comes from a farm. All of these domesticated fruits have been bred so that they're incredibly easy to approach, harvest, eat, all that. I mean, I can just pop a blueberry in my mouth. It's good to go. I can take a banana and I can unwrap it just like a candy bar and put it in my face, right? There's just so much else out there. The grocery store, I think, really, it's fantastic that we can go to one place and get an abundance of food, but it really, I think, limits our imagination and limits what we know is possible about food.
Perfect example in your book is the maraschino cherry, because, you know, now with all the craft cocktails, when it says maraschino cherries, most people go to their refrigerator and get the jar of red dye number 2 cherries and put one in, it completely ruins the cocktail. So you have, how long does it take to make, I forgot how long it takes to make the maraschino.
The longest part of this recipe is just pitting the cherries yourself.
Oh yeah, don't kill yourself, buy a cherry pitter.
Or the trip to the liquor store takes longer than everything else. All you need is a bardo of Luxardo Maraschino liqueur and some good sour cherries. You heat them up, you put them all together, and you, I seal them in a hot oven, and then you're good for a year.
Yeah, and it really does make a difference.
Yeah, it's delicious.
I was gonna ask you. Oh, because I used to do this too. And I know you talk, and it's, what's really good about the book is you bring your family is in it a lot, whether it's your father or your grandfather or aunts and your mother, and you know, talk, and that's a difficult situation too. But I like the part about your finest, fondest childhood memory about the Sears catalogs, because I used to love going through those.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I'm not alone. I always thought I was alone in that. That's great.
Well, plus I live on this property where it was built in 1775, and there's what's called a Sears garage, and they bought the garage out of the catalog back like in 1904. So
sure.
You could buy a Sears garage.
I used to live in a Sears Craftsman in Seattle.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they're all over.
What was it like? Is it nice?
It was, I think at one time it was nice. It was charming. I love living there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Burbank and Nazis.
Okay. What a transition. Let's talk about it.
Oh, okay. Right. So what's wrong with Luther Burbank? Why is he such an asshole?
All right. So Luther Burbank comes up in this book early on in my BlackBerry chapter. It's a BlackBerry. Within that chapter, I'm talking about Himalaya blackberries, which is a particular cultivar that Luther Burbank is credited with introducing to the United States. He brought them. He got them from a seed pack he thought was from the Himalayas, but really it's an Armenian blackberry. I mean, he was going, because it was so prolific, he wanted to crossbreed it with thornless blackberry vines that were less prolific to create a prolific thornless blackberry. Burbank was all about trying to create plants that were more beautiful, more prolific, more easier for humans to use and coexist with. He had this idea that you could, by combining plants with that each had a characteristic that you wanted, you could get towards a more perfect plant. So he was really, really early on in understanding how genes worked. So he wouldn't have used those words and didn't understand it that way.
And that sounds good.
That sounds good. But then it started to get into, he also became a proponent of eugenics and started to, he wrote a book called The Training of the Human Plant, where he uses his knowledge about how to create plant, you know, ideal. So his version of ideal plant cultivars and he applied that idea to how to create ideal humans, particularly in the United States. And if you read the book, there's a whole lot that will jump out to a modern reader as offensive and racist and absurd. And the eugenics, of course, was the movement that the Nazis used to justify their genocide. So it gets really dark really fast.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I didn't expect this at first when I started reading. Well, first of all your essays that are on your, you can get, again, on your website, you can get most of it, plus the loudness and all that, which we don't have time for that. But yeah, it's interesting how a lot of this is so metaphoric. And the reader has the opportunity to create the metaphor that comes to their mind. But it really is a good template for metaphor, because you have the fruit doing this, doing that, and then you immediately think of a person who's kind of like that, which is weird.
And that chapter early on was showing to me, as I was going down this rabbit hole of Luther Burbank, Himalaya blackberries, into eugenics, into World War II and genocide, I was just like, wow, like at this is a really great example of the limits of trying to think about people as plants. Of using plants as a metaphor for people. Though I do that throughout the book, that's one of the engines of the entire book. I mean, those metaphors always are half inhuman, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Plants are not people. Plants can help us understand ourselves and plants. And I think it's important and incredibly rewarding to find ways to be connected to plants, to have things in common with, to coexist, you know, find ways we truly coexist besides just eating and consuming. But, you know, there's limits to within this writing to, I think, to what you can understand about people by understanding plants.
Yeah. And what you do is in each chapter, no pun intended, but you branch off.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes very parenthetically, like in the journey when you go, doing this with a man who would never love me. You know, it's like, it's hilarious. I mean, I laughed out loud. I mean, you probably did when you were writing it. But or Sam
that part, but I was like, oh, so I'm the Durian now.
Exactly.
You know, you start all these moments are fairly accidental on purpose, I suppose. Like you kind of, I would get an idea of how, oh, it was more that I would start writing and start to repeat myself. So repeating myself in terms of saying, describing myself as someone who was unloved, but then also describing myself not loving the Durian, that provided structure for that chapter. I was like, oh, here we go. Here's some repetition, or here's a kind of rhyme within that essay that can tell me where to go next.
Yeah. And it's like when you talk about, for example, placebos, that was another good one, because, you know, I always look, you know, when you look, you prescribe something and you look at the drug instructions and the interactions, it always shows the difference in efficacy between placebo and not. It's like, 4%. So it's like, okay, I'm doing this. This is a 4% chance more than if I had a sugar pill. And then you talk about the difference in placebos too, between a sugar pill. Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk about that a little bit. That was very interesting.
I guess I was trying to understand, you know, can food be medicine? How is food medicine? What kind of metaphors do we use to identify our medicines? And if they are just metaphors, if they aren't actually, these fruits aren't actually interacting with our bodies in a way that maybe a penicillin pill would, what are they doing? Because they do us some good. And if they do us some good, what does that tell us about how powerful metaphors are, how powerful the way we imagine something is? So that's where placebos come in, is to me, that is proof of how powerful belief in something and the way we talk about something, the language we use to talk about something, that those are very powerful things that can impact us physically.
Yeah. I'm glad I brought that up about metaphor, because I wasn't sure you would agree with me, but now it sounds like wholeheartedly you do.
Oh yeah. That's the fun I was having with this book.
Okay. I give myself props for that.
Good job. Good reading.
And the other one is juniper, which, so my girlfriend loves gin. I can't stand it. It gives me a horrible headache, a horrible hangover. Whereas vodka doesn't in the slightest. So she gets a gin and a Hendrix and tonic, and I get a Stoli and tonic.
Good.
But I like the part about where you say gin is mother's poison.
Mother's ruin.
Mother's ruin. Because here I go again. But I had this friend and we went to his house, and the father ran a nuclear submarine, so he was never home. And she drank a lot of gin. And I said, wow, you really like that. And she goes, yeah, gin is like mother's milk to me. And then when the husband came home, we had dinner together. I was 16. So I didn't get the idea that she was kind of an alcoholic. And so I said, oh yeah, that reminds me when you said gin was like mother's milk to me. And eventually that was a start of a husband and wife fight that ended in a divorce.
Oh no.
Because, you know, he was gone for 6 months. Who knows what she did?
Sure.
And she was very flirty, too. But, okay, I do that. You got to stop me from doing that.
Okay. So we're talking about Mother's Ruin.
And your book.
Was associated with women in Britain maybe the 1800s. I'll have to fact check myself on that. But it also was a rumored abortifacient. So this would just come up in different sources that I was reading, little kind of quick asides that, you know, women, if they didn't want to have this child, might, you know, drink a bottle of gin or, you know, throw themselves down a set of stairs or try all sorts of ways to abort the child. But I could not find what I would consider a trustworthy source that this actually happened. I also couldn't find within texts about juniper, even that much information about it being an abortifacient. Though if I went to a text like Gabriel Hamilton's, it's the Encyclopedia of Folk Medicine. If you look up abortion and abortifacients, it will show up there, for example. So there's this kind of weird one-way flow of information about juniper's connection to herbal methods, historical herbal methods of abortion.
And the other thing that you bring out is that one of the reasons why you can't find the actual documentation is that the doctors and everybody else, just like when you asked about cyanide, everyone's very circumspect.
Yes.
They don't actually come out and say it. They say something like it about the womb, but they don't specifically say this is what it's going to do.
And we don't know exactly why each of those sources would have said it their particular way, but would have been cagey about it. We know that abortion has been something shameful and taboo for a very long time. And that historically, these methods that women use to control their own fertility were taboo. And so the transmission of that knowledge has been broken consistently throughout history.
There are a couple of other
fun mystery to try to delve into. You know it's there, but you can't find the source.
And that's a lot of your book is like that too, is, as you said, going down rabbit holes.
Yeah,
it's the other one that was interesting because I'm looking at it right now is my Osage orange tree.
Oh, you have one?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. So, you know, in the beginning, I've been here 20 years. When I I would go out and cut it in half and think, okay, I can eat this. And then of course, yuck. And then I thought, well, I can slice a little bit off and it'll be perfect in a gin and tonic or a vodka and tonic, which it kind of was, but wasn't. Yeah. And then, so then what I did was I would just take them off the tree and throw them at this roof of this potting shed I had to see if I could get hit the roof and then go over.
Yes, there you go.
But then I mistakenly would miss the roof and go through the window of the kitchen, and my ex-wife would be, part of the reason she's my ex-wife is because I would do a lot of things like that.
So she kept breaking her kitchen window?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
But yeah, so talk about the Osage Eye, because when I cut it in half the first time, I said, who the hell designed this? Uh-huh. It's just like, you know, what's the point? It's just nothing but seeds.
And what a cool reminder that fruit, you know, co-evolves with animals, but not necessarily with humans.
Right. Right?
Yeah. The in my research, what I the theory that I encountered was that Osage oranges, which are these kind of green, brainy looking balls about the size of a softball, that they co-evolved with megafauna in the Pleistocene, I believe, and that their natural seed dispersal system, which would have been these animals, died out, but they didn't. So now humans are dispersing them throughout North America because they make a really good shelter belt. So we don't eat them, but we use them to protect land from wind. They use them, the WPA used them.
Also, unless I'm wrong, and unless it's a variant of Osage orange, these have really sharp thorns on them.
Oh, you mean the branches do?
Yeah.
Yes, that is.
Yeah, and so I couldn't get through those. They would be impossible to get through. I guess basically everybody, every living thing is trying to replicate itself, wants to reproduce. So all those seeds really do make a difference, whether animals are eating them and pooping them out or whatever happens to them. And that's the idea, is this is what we have to do. We got to keep going.
Yeah.
And that comes out of persimmon is another good one like that. Yeah. But
how so?
I don't know. It just seems like, well, who eats persimmons? I mean, what animals eat persimmons? Sorry.
Persimmons.
I know you eat them. Well, you're an animal too. But I mean, who are the other animals, not humans, that eat persimmons?
Oh, deer, maybe? I don't know.
I don't know either, but it seems like they would propagate easily that way through also. But yeah. In any event, hey, when you wrote this, since you talk about smoke all the time, not cigarettes, but although that's interesting. Why do you talk about cigarettes so much? Not that much. Do you still smoke 30 a year? Do you still?
No, I don't. No, that's all over. That's all over. That's part of when it's like, say, my husband used to smoke, you know, I'm not sure how many packs a day. I wasn't with him when he was a smoker, but he was a long time smoker. So me smoking even just a little bit, he just drives him nuts because he still does miss those cigarettes. So it was a lot easier. It was good for our relationship. It was good for my own health to be like, I don't need to do this anymore. I don't have that gene, the one that absolutely loves smoking, but I did enjoy my cigarette every now and then with friends. So.
It's when I wake up in the morning and have my cup of coffee. That's when it does it.
Sure.
That's when I have to have it. But so anyway, the other kind of smoke, when you were writing this, that's when the fires were?
I mean, they're still happening, but I mean, not right now, but while I was writing this, it was becoming clear in my region, I live in the Inland Northwest, that we were starting to have a new season near the end of the summer. That was smoke season, wildfire season. We're expecting another one this year. It's been really, really dry.
I thought about it because like, olfactorily, it must have impinged on some of the things you were doing because this did it?
Yes. Well, I mean, and within the chapter that you're referring to is ume, where I'm making this, I'm making umeboshi, which are kind of a health food, but I have to dry them outside while there's wildfire smoke in the air. So the irony of that I thought was useful for an essayist anyway. And it also made me think about, you know, will we be here in 5 years when these are ready to go? I mean, I hope so. But last year, the wildfires were so bad. We were stuck in our house for over a week and we had to wear masks to bed because our house leaked.
Really?
It was awful. Yeah, it just was profoundly disconnecting experience for all of us in this whole area. And it was affecting, the entire Pacific Northwest. So
yeah.
ongoing environmental problem.
Yes, it's something that, you know, you you talk about climate change, but you are living right in the middle of it.
Yeah. Well, and we're on the tail, you know, the ways that we have managed. I mean, I'm going to step in here because I think now that we're experiencing everyone's being affected by fires. Everyone has an opinion of what should be done to prevent the fires. I'm not really educated enough about this, but I do know enough to get myself in trouble. So what I know is that native tribes in this area practiced controlled burns for millennia and used that as an agricultural technique. And I think we're starting to understand that that was a smarter way to handle our forests than to suppress fire constantly. Because now we've got a tinderbox all over the West that's been going up.
Yeah.
Anyway, now we're way beyond the scope of my book, except actually that does lead us to talk about huckleberries, which is a plant that thrives the year after a forest fire. So it needs that kind of canopy clearing fires to let some more light in so that they can continue their bushy ways out from the mountains.
Yeah, I've been in forests where there's been decimation, and then the next year you see all this incredible green, all this growth.
Yeah, the renewal is fantastic and faster, I think, than it's hard to imagine how fast it can be. But I remember whenever we learn about Mount St. Helens and that disaster in 1980, what's always part of that story is how surprised everybody was, how surprised scientists were at how quickly plants came back and animals came back. And talk about seed dispersal systems. I can't remember there was a rodent that was up there that was, you know, dispersing all sorts of seeds as it was digging under the ground. And these wonderful flowers came up, I think, even just a year later.
It was back in 1980? That was in 80?
Yeah.
Wow. I never would have thought it was that long ago. Hey, we haven't talked about any of the recipes because the title says with recipes. And so the first one is the Aronia smoothie, because again, my girlfriend makes a smoothie every morning and starts out with leafy greens. And she has this Vitamix, which is loud. It must be 120 decibels. It's louder than a 747. It drives me crazy. But then when she brings it up and drinks it while she's getting ready, it looks like raw sewage. And she's tried to get me onto it, but I just can't do it. And so talk about the Aronia. Yeah. Am I pronouncing, is it Aronia?
Yeah,
or?
Aronia. Yeah. So the Aronia berry may be better known to folks out there as the choke berry. It's been rebranded from its scientific name. I think it's Aronia melanocarpa. Aronia is a little bit easier to sell than a fruit that has the word choke in it, right? But these berries are so astringent. That's what gives them their choke. That astringency is accompanied by anthocyanins, which are the properties that are, so let's see, am I going to get this right? You know what? I did very careful research for this chapter, wrote it all down, and I can't remember it enough to get it straight. So basically, Aronia, let me summarize this way so I don't get things totally wrong. Read the book. It's in the book. It's absolutely correct in the book. I just can't remember it. Aronias are being marketed as a health food because they supposedly have lots of antioxidants. And antioxidants are often found in astringent fruits and very, very dark colored fruits. Aronia is both of these things. So it really gave me an opportunity to think about how I associate things that don't taste very good with health, right? The worse it tastes, the better it is for you. And so this Aronia smoothie is one that Sam, my husband, finally was like, what happened? Like, these used to be good.
I know.
And now it just, it tastes terrible. And I was like, it's good for you. It's going to make you live forever.
Yeah, I love when you talk about the various, I don't have it in front of me, but the various maladies that can be cured, including, you know, and you stick some of them in there that are obviously you.
Right.
The maladies that can be cured. I forgot. I wish I could list them all. I have it somewhere. But yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah. So have you had the opportunity, and it's kind of in the book, have you had the opportunity to use any of these difficult fruits in your pie making? Have you been able to cross over?
You know, I actually am not making pies all that much anymore.
You're making cheese.
I'm making cheese instead, exactly. And I did make pie this summer because the pandemic, I lost a bunch of my freelance gigs. So I opened up an illegal pie stand down at my local farm and was making rhubarb pies and apple pies and stuff. And that was really fun. So I'll do that every now and then. But mostly what I'm making is cheese. And I was doing a lot of fruit preserving and vegetable preserving. So that's where, I mean, there's crossover in this book with like Huckleberry, for example, because the best way to eat huckleberries besides straight is in a huckleberry pie. But mostly I think, yeah, my interests are now, how do I take, you know, some beautiful raw food substance and make it last, and by trying to make it last, transform it into something interesting.
Next week, I'm interviewing this guy who wrote a book Next week, I'm interviewing this guy who wrote a book called The Cheesemonger's Guide to the British Isles.
Oh, I should read that one.
Yeah.
I'm still in the phase right now. So I'm a apprentice to Laura Lee Misterly of Coolisasket Farm. She's up on the North Columbia, close to Canada. And that's through the Washington Center for Cultural Traditions. And so for the last 2 or 3 years now, I've just been doing what she tells me to do. I haven't actually done a whole lot of research into cheese making just yet, in part because I just want to understand what is her take on how this can be done. So I've been learning how to make farmer cheese. I've been learning how to then take that farmer cheese and turn it into blue cheese. I'm making brie right now because I can't get goat milk, but I can get cow milk. So we're trying out brie and just learning kind of all the ways that I can turn the mistakes I'm making into something edible.
It's funny because that reminds me of the cheese sketch in Monty Python, and shrubs reminded me of the Knights Who Say Nye. But no one's going to, I mean, okay, explain a shrub, because people out there are not going to understand until they read the book, most people. So sure. I thought it was a shrubbery.
Sure, it's old fashioned soda. They're pretty popular in Portland, for example. I think you can buy them canned, not canned, bottled. But they're a vinegar base. It's usually equal parts fruit, vinegar, and sugar, if I remember correctly. You stir them up, let them sit for a while, strain it. If you like the way it tastes, awesome. If you want it to have a more pungent berry flavor, fruit flavor, put some more fruit in there and just let it sit a little bit longer. You can drink that straight if you want, but I prefer it with a little sparkling water.
Where my bookstore is, we sell coffee, but then this coffee shop moved in down the street and their lease precludes another coffee shop, but they let us still sell coffee. So we started trying to sell cordials.
Oh, interesting.
With elderberry.
Yeah. And
it has that spritzer thing that's beautiful. It's a big brass thing that carbonates the water. So we're experimenting with cordials now.
It's like a soda fountain?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's cool.
I know.
That's really cool. And I'm assuming by cordials, you mean the non-alcoholic kind?
Correct. Yeah. Everyone asks, but yes. Right. But right. I do have some vodka in the back of the store. So
special occasions.
Yeah, special customers.
Good. That sounds really good.
Okay. Well, are you sick of me? It's 53 minutes and 50 seconds.
Oh, we did good. This was a great interview.
Yeah, it was.
Thanks so much.
And yeah, the book, you know, it's on the front table. And I should get the British version too. I will. I'm gonna set both of them next to
each other. Gooseberries. You need them.
I'm not saying I like it better, but I kind of like
it. They're both good. They're both good next to each other. My mother did say she likes this one better.
She did?
Yeah, she's like, oh.
I can always tell when a publisher likes an author because they emboss. Oh. You don't get embossing unless they think your book's gonna do really well.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And deckled, well, you didn't get deckled edges though.
That's for the next book. We'll see how this one does. Maybe next time I'll get deckled edges.
Or you'll probably hand deckle them yourself and move into, oh yeah, because you talk about paper.
Right.
Making paper. All right, I could go on forever.
Paper. There's all sorts of things you can do with fruit that decide.
Okay. All right. Everyone should read it. Everyone should come in my store and get it.
Absolutely.
And hopefully we'll talk again.
That's good. Take care. Thanks so much, Sam.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.